Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a thoughtful slice in the deluxe sandwich that is arts and culture across Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we get both comical and criminal as we dust off a vacant lot by way of a Hancock revitalisation, explore a packed programme of laughs as part of Birmingham's forthcoming comedy festival by way of a proper chat with comedian Lindsay Santoro, and we step into the murky underworld of a true crime thriller as we talk to writer A.A. Abbott about her forthcoming thriller, The Revenge Trail. There's also a roundup of events and happenings to drop into your diary. If you'd like further information on the items in this show or to catch up on previous episodes, you can check out our blog at www.thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk, and you can listen again to past shows on our website www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. And so we start with a giant of British comedy cunningly brought back to the stage as part of Birmingham Comedy Festival, which runs until the 14th of October. Vacant Lot explores two lost scripts written for Tony Hancock by West Brom's Larry Stevens, dormant in the BBC archive until now. Following an energetic performance at Stourbridge Town Hall, I caught up with cast members Richard Usher and Mark Earby to help get a handle on these unknown outings. Fresh from their performance on the stage of Lost Hancock's Vacant Lot, with Richard and with Mark, two of the cast. And thanks for taking time to talk to me.
Pleasure.
Let's start talking about Vacant Lot and what it is, because fans of Hancock might not know what it is. They're kind of lost script. So Richard, let's start exploring that.
Sure. Well, it was originally written in 1952 for Tony Hancock by his longtime friend Larry Stevens, who also at that point was co-writing The Goon Show with Spike Milligan. And it was going to be potentially the first ever British sitcom. And there are BBC memos that have been flying around mentioning the word sitcom a good 3 or 4 years before the acknowledged idea of a sitcom. And it was never completed, never recorded, went through various changes and then disappeared. And just recently, Larry Stevens' cousin, Julie Warren, has been researching a book about her cousin, who died tragically quite young. And she's trying to set the record straight about him. In the process of researching it, she kept seeing these references to these scripts called Vacant Lot. And she was at the BBC Written Archives Centre and did the research, and they found the scripts, and they are what they are, and they're amazing two pieces of great radio comedy writing.
That's an incredible find, isn't it?
Yes, I think. It is.
Come to Chedley Bay, resort of bankrupts and international unknowns. Sunbathe on the golden slopes of the Corporation Slag Heap, or doze lazily in the cool shadows of the Erpington Road gasworks. Lacerate your feet on the specially sharpened stones of the beach. Bathe in the calm waters of our famous Cabbage Lane static water tank. And all this misery for only twice what you would pay anywhere else. Yes, forget Palm Beach, Florida, where the turf meets the surf. Choose Chudley Bay, where the drains meet the sea.
The premise of Vacant Lot, just for our listeners at home, is Tony Hancock is an auctioneer in a seaside town which has the kind of faded glory of a past resort, should we say, and he's surrounded by a cast of quite quirky and strange characters. And both of you help, I think, brilliantly to bring that to life, because that quirkiness and that eccentricity you bring very much to the stage. So Mark, how did you get involved in this project?
Well, me and Richard have been friends since we were senior school, since we were 13, and 33 years. We both found that we had a love of The Goon Show and 50s radio comedy Hancock, and we've been doing silly voices for donkey's years. Richard went into voiceover work, I became an actor, and then by chance, Dave, the producer of the show here, was doing The Goon Show. We got involved in that, and from there, Richard's a member of the Goon Show Preservation Society, and Julie Warren was talking about that. He got in touch with her because of that and found the scripts, and they came our way after doing The Goon Show to Dave. And they're great scripts. They really had a lot of fun to be involved in.
So there's two scripts as part of the show that you performed this evening.
Yeah.
And they are, I think, a kind of a collection of very almost slapstick situations, if you like. Mm. I mean, slapstick's difficult to do on radio, I think. It's fair to say.
I think it's probably polite farce rather than French farce or rather than the 70s sort of drop your trousers farce. Mm. It's a series of very farcical situations that he gets involved in, has to run around the town to try and solve himself, you know.
So how difficult is it as actors, and particularly as voice actors, I know you do a number of different things, but how difficult is it to stage the staging of a radio play? So, you know, it's very popular at the moment, I think, to sort of bring back, refresh, reinvigorate, I think is the right word to use, old scripts or lost scripts. But how difficult is it in terms of the parameters of something like this?
Well, certainly if you take it back to, say, The Goon Show as an example of the way we did it, you're looking at a thing on three or four levels because you're actors, playing characters who in turn sometimes play characters, which gets mind-boggling. But that's the sort of thing you're doing. So you're recreating a scene in a radio studio, and therefore you're performing as though you were Peter Sellers or Spike Milligan or Tony Hancock or whoever was playing the parts, recording a radio production. So therefore, when you do that on stage, you have to give over some kind of energy, and it's for an audio medium, you've got to be very visual. So we get quite busy on stage doing little bits of business and trying to make it come across as physically as possible whilst all at the same time being that thing that creates mind pictures, the theatre of the mind.
On the stage, people need to see a story as well as hear it, whereas in the radio, you leave it all to your mind. So if the people are there physically and you just stood there, it would die somewhere along the line. People would still understand what's going on, but it would be a lot less interesting to see and watch. Yeah. So you need to give them a visual element as well. So you've got to sort of physicalise some of the characterisations as well.
And Richard, you have what I would say a prop. There are very few props, but you have a very professional pair of glasses throughout the piece that you use, I think, with great effect and authority.
Oh, thank you. Well, I guess I'd call them my Sellers horn rims, because throughout his career, he had the horn rim specs were a sort of Sellers trademark, really, Peter Sellers' trademark. And so that kind of allows you to, A, put across the fact that you're potentially playing Peter Sellers, but also, you know, pulling the glasses down over the nose to sort of take on the role of Pemble and be a sort of wizened old man, and then to put them up to be a slightly more pompous character. So, yeah, it's an interesting physical way of translating that to the audience.
Whereas I just needed the glasses to see.
Fair enough. And what is it, I'm interested to know from both of you, what is it that makes Hancock endure as a figure and as a comedic actor?
His timing is second to none. He's a great everyman character. This is an earlier version of the Hancock character where he's still trying to be sort of aspire to be something he's not quite, whereas later on in the Hancock half hour, he dropped all that pretense and just became an ordinary everyman downtrodden. So he's trying to aspire to something he's not quite capable of in these things, and the cast of crazies around him frustrate him in every sense of the word. So he's legitimately frustrated and railing against what's happening, because every time he tries to do something good, something else trips him over.
Yeah.
And just finally, I'm just interested to know, personally, when was the first time you kind of encountered Hancock or became aware of the phenomena of Hancock?
I came to know Hancock through Mark, because when we were at school together, we sort of bonded over looking through script books and looking at old 50s comedies like The Goon Show and Hancock's Half Hour, Itmar, things like that. And so that was my sort of first inkling of what Hancock was and reading the scripts together. And then I found out what more about them by getting the LPs out of the library and listening to them and just being, you know, blown away by the whole concept of Hancock's Half Hour and falling in love with that character. I think it's amazing.
And for me, my dad got me introduced to it when I was about 8 years old with the things like The Blood Donor and Radio Ham and The Missing Page. I listened to those cassettes forever, and I've still got recordings of them now. They're never going to go away. You know, I fell in love with that then, and it's never really gone away ever since.
Well, Richard, Mark, it's been great to talk to you, and I've really enjoyed the performance. I think
Thank you.
Did great work in terms of bringing the legacy of the work to life, so all credit to you. We're sitting in the library now, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and seek out a copy of Lady Don't Fall Back.
It has been written. You can get a Kindle version.
We shall seek that out, but thanks, and best of luck with whatever you do next.
Thank you
very much indeed.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Right, I've got just about enough time for a quick cough and a drag.
Vacant Lot, The Lost Hancocks was a Birmingham Comedy Festival production, co-commissioned by Creative Black Country's Funny Things, written by Larry Stevens, and produced by Dave Freak. For more information, go to www.bmconfest.co.uk, and for more information on the lad himself, go to www.tonyhancock.org.uk. And now news of a brand new homegrown digital festival brought to us by Mac Birmingham. Little Geeks is a mix of spooky tricks and treats that starts on Saturday the 27th of October and runs until Friday the 2nd of November. If you fancy live shows, virtual reality, gaming, workshops for young and old, you can check out a pixel-packed programme at macbirmingham.co.uk/little-geeks. There's even a marshmallow laser feast, but you'll have to find out about that one for yourselves. Modern crime thriller now, as I catch up with author A.A. Abbott to get some insight on her latest Birmingham-based tale of passion, vodka, envy and intrigue, The Revenge Trail, prior to its official launch on the 1st of October as part of Dyslexia Awareness Month. Dizzied by the potential twists and turns, I started to sleuth out the story.
So I'm in a mysterious secret location, somewhere in the heart of Birmingham, it seems. I'm here with Helen, and Helen writes with a different name of A.A. Abbott, and we're here really to talk about crime, I think, and writing of crime, because very excitingly you've got a new book, a fourth in the series book, coming out. So let's talk about that to start with.
Thanks very much, James. My latest book is The Revenge Trail, and it's the fourth in a series called The Trail Series, funnily enough. They're all crime thrillers set in Birmingham, and they follow the fortunes of two families and a vodka business.
See, I'm already intrigued by that. So firstly, let's start with Birmingham. You've got a Birmingham connection. Why have you chosen sort of Birmingham as a landscape for dark intrigue?
I really like Birmingham. In fact, I love Birmingham. I lived here for nearly 20 years. I moved away because of my work, but I love to come back. I feel Birmingham's a very interesting place with lots of secret highways and byways. The canal system spreading across the city, for example.
It does have, at the moment, it does seem to be very popular with folks that want to explore organised crime and gangster-type stories. I'm thinking Peaky Blinders, those kind of things. There's something, there's an allure about it, I think, isn't there?
You obviously see Birmingham as quite a dark, mysterious city yourself.
So why did you choose a life of crime, as it were? Why did you sort of choose to specialise in writing crime fiction and crime novels? Because I know you've, I think, touched on horror and romance in your past.
Yeah.
Is there something about the genre that appeals to you?
I think I naturally fell into it because I feel that sex, drugs and murder perk up a book quite a lot.
Yes.
And that kind of pushes you naturally in the crime thriller direction, I find.
So the book itself launches, I think, on the 1st of October.
That's
which is
right.
Coming up fast. And there's an interesting link, I think, isn't there, to that date, because it falls in a particular week.
That's right. It's National Dyslexia Week, I'm really keen on making my books accessible. There's been dyslexia in my family for four generations, and I'm not dyslexic, but my brother is, loads of my relatives are, and I wanted them to have the pleasure of reading my books too. So as well as having an e-book and traditional paperback version, I also publish a dyslexia-friendly large print version, which is really, really easy to read.
And that's something I guess you've kind of, I suppose, campaigned for, really. It's something you've sort of been adamant that is a factor of technically how your books are produced, and other people, I think, thankfully, have taken that on board.
Certainly, other independent authors and publishers have started to do it. The mainstream publishers won't touch it because they say there's no market in it, but it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, isn't it? Because if you don't publish, nobody's going to be able to buy the books in the first place. Expose the product to the risk of being sold, I say.
Now let's talk, let's go back to The Revenge Trail. Let's talk about some of the meat of the book, if you like, and that's probably a good word to use. You mentioned kind of vodka, okay, and there's mixed into the vodka is, I think, a hint of capitalism, perhaps. but there's a bit of revenge and envy and passion in the story. We don't want to give too much away, because obviously people have got to engross themselves in the book, but there's quite a heady mix of themes, I think.
Interestingly, the revenge trail isn't just about vodka, although that's a big part of it. The vodka angle comes about when Marty Bridges, a Birmingham businessman who's used to getting his vodka from the former Soviet Union, has a problem with his supply. And that means that he's got to turn to one of his business associates to help him. She's a young woman called Kat White. She makes the best vodka in the world. She's really, really clever. But she and Marty, although they've done business together, don't really trust each other. So there's an uneasy relationship there as Marty turns to somebody for help when he'd really not have to ask. At the same time, Kat has done some rather dodgy things in her past. Although she's young, she has annoyed an East End crime villain very, very badly. He's in prison, but in the revenge trail, he's doing his absolute best to get out and get his own back on her. He's determined to kill her, and nothing's going to get in his way.
Tell me about him in terms of researching the book, and I guess finding the facts, which is always important, I think, even in fiction, you've got to base it on something. You've done, I think, a vodka. We'll go back to vodka, because I think you've done some research on vodka, not just drinking lots of vodka, but you've kind of...
That too.
Well, you've done a bit of that. Have a look around the kind of process in terms of how that's made. But also, you mentioned kind of crime bosses and, you know, kind of murky characters. I think you've sort of... You've done some work with prisons, or you've spoken to prisons about the environment and the...
Sure.
...the impact of crime.
I've spoken to a couple of prison officers. If I do anything on police procedure, I tend to get a policeman to have a look just to make sure that I've got that right. I've found that prison officers who do a fantastic job in very difficult circumstances are really, really helpful. They don't particularly want to be named because they don't particularly want people turning up on their doorsteps, but they've been really helpful in giving me an idea of what prison life is like. And what it seems to be like is quite boring most of the time, but violence can kick off at any second. And that's where prison life is different from normal life. There's an edge to it all the time. You just never know what might happen next and how nasty it might be.
There's an underlying kind of tension, I think, isn't there? The other thing I was going to ask you about is in terms of your writing process, it's very different, I think, for different authors and people that write different genres. But how, I guess, what I'd be really interested to know is how you come up with a premise for something, how you get the idea and how you develop that kind of narrative. Is that something that, you know, when it hits you, you kind of capture it straight away, or do you mull it over in your mind and then comes out at a later time? How does it practically work for you?
Oh, God knows. It's entirely random, I'm afraid. So... sometimes I get an idea for a plot and then I just go and write down a few notes and later on it becomes a book. But sometimes I might wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh yeah, I know what character X is actually up to. I know what her game is. And it will solve a big problem that I've got and make the book more interesting.
Now, also, audience is important because obviously you need folks to read your books. And I'm just interested how, in early drafts, people are involved in helping tweak what you do. I've read that there's a kind of group of hardened crime readers who help you perhaps inform some of those earlier drafts for a formal editing process.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, all the books do get a full structural edit, and that's done by a lady called Catherine D'Souza in Birmingham, and she writes really good books herself. In fact, she writes women's fiction, and what's amazing about Catherine D'Souza is that she can edit any genre. So even though she writes women's fiction, she edits my crime thrillers and sprinkles fairy dust over them, and she edits Denis Zaslona's children's ghost stories as well. They're absolutely fantastic, but they're totally different. Coming back to my draft readers, James, I get about 20 people minimum to read my first competent draft. When I say the first competent draft, it's the draft that I feel happy to let people see. I give them a huge long feedback questionnaire. They get asked 30 questions. They're along the lines of, did they like the first sentence? Did they like the first paragraph? Did they like the first page? Were the bits of the book that they didn't like, where it didn't flow? Was it stuff that was clunky? Was it believable? All kinds of stuff I ask them. And I tell them to be honest, and my God, they are.
Thank you.
The other aspect, I think, that you work collectively with others on is the designs of the books. And I have to say that the title pages, the covers, the jackets, if you like, are fantastic. They look, you know, they're really striking designs. And I think the latest, you've been doing a bit of work sort of with others on Facebook and other places to try and really get a kind of, you know, make sure you get maximum impact.
Absolutely. So usually I'd go with a professional cover designer because they really know what they're doing. For example, a guy in King's Heath called Paul Humphreys designed my book After the Interview, which has got a lovely picture of Birmingham on the front. And a guy called Stuart Bache designed the Trail Series covers for the first three. But he's so popular that I didn't book him in time for the last one. So Stuart Bache gave me some tips on how to design a book cover. And I had a go and then posted on Facebook. And 300 people advised me on how to get the best possible book cover out of my rough draft. And it is good. It's a cracking yellow and black cover. Shadows, contrasts, excitement.
And that's a really important part of a book, isn't it? You know, the classic cliche is never judge a book by its cover, but the cover really, you know, like the opening line of a book, it's part of the hook, isn't it? It's what kind of draws people in. It's what gets people to pick it up, I guess.
Yeah, and that one for the Revenge Trail is absolutely lovely. It's based on a picture that I took in the nick at Steelhouse Lane. Not when I was a guest at Her Majesty's Pleasure, but after they'd stopped using it, they opened it to the public for a day last year. I snooped around.
Now, the other aspect of your writing and your kind of literary activity, as it were, is you're a critic. You're quite active in terms of reading and writing about other people's work.
Mm, I love reading crime thrillers too. I absolutely love reading. One of life's greatest pleasures.
And is that harder or easier to do, given your trade, as it were? Do you find it easier to write about other books and novels, given that you kind of write fiction, or is it harder because you don't want to sort of give the game away or be too critical, is it?
I feel I'm more analytical now when I read books than I used to be when I wasn't writing so much. I still really enjoy picking up a book and just reading it. And if I've loved a book, then I like to tell people about it, possibly by blogging and also by posting reviews on Amazon and on Goodreads. The vast majority of readers never post reviews at all, and I think it's a real shame because we writers absolutely love reviews, both good and bad. Obviously, we love the good ones more because it proves that people are enjoying what we read.
And taking the book out and about, sort of to audiences and to workshops and things like that, you're doing some of that, I think, in the run-up to the launch. And how easy is that to do? Do people sort of... I'm guessing it's quite different from a gig. You don't get heckled when you do a reading, but do you find yourself...
No, you don't. Don't encourage people to do it.
But do you find yourself kind of tweaking things as you've done a reading, or perhaps if you're sort of presenting an early draft from audience feedback, or...?
I've never done that, but that's a good shout, actually. If it's not the final version and I see something that could be better, then I would improve it. I think that's a really good idea.
Now, you are, I think it's true to say, you've mentioned in a couple of the responses, you are a lover of reading and of writing. And I was just interested in the kind of technical dimension of reading. We were talking just earlier about how people read and how they explore books. And your website, I know, is very encouraging in terms of saying to people, look, it needn't be arduous and you needn't have to take hours and, you know, lots of time. You can enter it, you know, in short bites, if you like. But actually, it's about making time for, you know, that indulgence. And I suppose what I'm trying to get to is, nowadays it's very accessible to get books and to read books. Do you think that changes people's relationships with stories and perhaps what they get from stories?
I suspect that people are actually reading more than ever before because there's so many different formats you can use. And for example, with the Kindle, you can just pop it in your pocket. You can pop it in your handbag. It's not like carrying a huge, big book around. And audiobooks are getting more important, and that's the format that I want to get into as well.
We mentioned your website earlier on, which I'd encourage folks to have a look at, and I think it's important to spell it out. So it's Abbott with two B's and two T's, .co.uk. Okay? And if you go on there, you can find all sorts of things, and there are some freebies as well. I think there's a free ebook that people can download, which is great.
Free short stories.
Free short stories. You can go onto Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and all those wonderful things. And you can also buy your books, I think, on a, let's just say, a large online retailer named after a river. You can go and have a look on there. You've got a newsletter as well that people can get a hold of through the website.
Yeah, sure. Just go to aaabbott.co.uk, sign up for the newsletter, and you'll get special offers, details of book launch parties, and a free ebook of short stories.
Excellent. Now, just to finish, let's just reiterate, launching on the 1st of October, the new book. Is that launch night, launch party?
Launch night in Birmingham at The Alchemist.
It's the place to be. But for now, Helen, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you. Great to meet you, James.
You're listening to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy. More laughing matters now as I ready myself for Birmingham Comedy Festival, which runs from Friday the 5th to Sunday the 14th of October at various venues across the city. To explain the art and the pain, I spoke to local stand-up star Lindsay Santoro.
So, we're talking comedy, and I'm with Lindsay Santoro, which is very exciting. Thank you, Lindsay, for coming in. Hello.
Hello.
And we'll start, I think, by telling our listeners a little bit about you. I think that's important. We've got to get behind the character.
I want people to know who I am as a person rather than...
I think that's a fundamental, isn't it? Now, one of the first things that I found out about you is that you are very local, okay? So in terms of Birmingham, and it's a good
thing. You make it sound like I live in a bin outside.
I didn't research that far, you are from Northfield.
I am, unfortunately, for my sins, I am, yeah.
So the first thing, I guess, for anyone outside of Birmingham that may stray onto this channel, what would... Describe Northfield for us. What kind of a community is Northfield?
It's a beautiful suburban area of Birmingham where we all come together and if you've not had a baby by age 16, there's something wrong with you. But if you ever want to meet someone, just either stand outside the pub up the top of the road or one of the local betting shops, because that's where we'll all be and that's the community spirit of Northfield.
How has Northfield coloured what you do in terms of your comedy? How would you say it's kind of... Did it spur you on, or does it constantly give you inspiration?
Well, you make it sound like I'm trying to get out of some kind of cesspit, but it's really it's actually all right. I like Northfield. I do. I'm a bit harsh on it, but it's. I think it's kept me quite grounded. It makes me sound like I'm in some voluptuous world of.
Razzmatazz.
Yeah, but I'm not. I'll go and do a gig, and then I'll go back to my house with my cat, and that's it. Northfield, back to. I love Northfield. Northfield, keep saying it.
Now that's the other thing as well that I find when I search who you are online, it's the phrase "down to earth" is a one that frequently used to describe you and your comedy.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That means common.
Is that what it means? Is that what it means? Common. Okay. I thought it meant you had a great way of sort of relating to audiences.
Yeah, because if they're posh, they go, "Oh, bless her, she's common," and if they're common, they go, "She's one of." I've got no airs and graces about me, and I think that might make me a bit relaxed. But I don't know, it depends. I don't know what I'm talking about.
You don't hold any punches?
No, but I'm not aggressive, I don't think. Oh, I feel like I'm having a deep and meaningful psychological session with you now.
So what kind of kick-started you on comedy? What got you thinking, well, do you know what, I can tell stories or I could get a laugh?
I'm not... generic looking attractive woman, so I thought, how can I get the attention of people? So I thought, by being a div. And it turns out being a div is actually quite funny. And I did a comedy course at one of the art centres with my friend, and at the end of it I was surprised to find that I wasn't awful. I mean, I was quite bad, but I wasn't like terrible. And then I progressed, kept doing comedy, kept doing local gigs for no money, kept driving all this way to do 5 minutes in front of some old man and a withered bit of crisps. Like, you know, it's just like that's how it goes. And then I thought, you know, I actually enjoy this. And I feel that the more stage time I have, the more I can be myself on stage rather than... Because it's really difficult standing up there and... You're almost bearing your soul, going, please find me funny. And if they don't, oh, it's horrible.
And do you find you kind of have to sort of bounce off an audience? I don't mean physically, but what I mean is... I'm guessing that, you know, it's very difficult to stand in front of an audience of people and just be instantly funny. I guess a warmer audience kind of helps you sort of release some of the material? Is that how it works?
I find it hard to judge audiences the more I'm doing it. Cause sometimes you'll go and think, oh, God, they're not going to get me. They're not going to like this. And then they will. They'll love it. And you think, wow. And then sometimes you'll go and do a gig and you'll go look at them and different. You'll go, yeah, they'll get this. They're my level. And they'll look at you like you've set your face on fire and put it out with a brick. So it's quite difficult to judge. I never take for granted what's in front of you. But I think it's always important to start with a strong joke. And when I have one, I think I'll have truly made it.
So are you writing things all the time, or are you one of these comedians that perhaps captures ideas or, you know, sort of abstracts and then builds them in front of the audience? How does it work for you?
For me, it's I will normally start with a little story, and I don't try it, first of all, in front of an audience. I know that sounds very odd. So something funny will happen to me, because I do little bits, little stories rather than one-liners. So I will maybe go round to my friend's house, like a group of girls, and shall I tell you the story about the bean sprout or something? And I'll tell the story about the bean sprout, like it's a general conversation. And I think, and if my friends find it hilarious, I think, all right, then I'll try it on another group of friends. I won't tell them that I'm trying comedy. They don't know this. And then if it works with another group of friends, I think, oh, I can probably work this into the show. The story with the bean sprout is basically I thought I was dying. I had to take a stool sample to the doctor and they said it's a bean sprout. I hadn't chewed it. Let's see. But the story itself is a bit longer.
It's a common problem, I'm sure.
So,
and you've kind of been working, I suppose, on the circuit, let's call it that. You've been doing gigs and, you know, going out and about in your trade, as it were, for the last sort of 4 years, is that right?
Yeah, about 4 years now. When I first did the course, for about a year, 6 months afterwards, I didn't do any comedy. I stopped. And it was only because I joined this women's comedy forum. Thank God for Facebook, because I'd never get gigs. Can I just say that now? And this lady had posted up saying, King's Heath, which is like central Birmingham way, I've got a female comedy night, new material, who wants to do it? And I thought, well, do you know what? If I don't do it again, I won't do it again, will I? So I messaged her and she said, fine. And her name's Maureen Younger. She's based in London, but she runs comedy nights around, some bits around the Midlands, some bits in London. I went on, did I think my third gig. She was very honest. She was like, for a third gig, that's pretty good. Let me book you for some more gigs. And it was because of Maureen that I carried on doing comedy, genuinely, because otherwise the laziness within me, I would not have bothered. Thank God for Maureen.
And in those last sort of 3 to 4 years, what have you changed in terms of your act or your style? Are you conscious that you've changed? Obviously, you have developed since you've come that second and third gig. But have you thought, oh yeah, actually, they were right. I really do need to kind of, you know.
It's really difficult. I think some people have a natural ability to stand up in front of people and talk. I can chat rubbish to you because it's just me and you. But if there's a group of
the
people,
art of radio,
yeah. You start panicking. Obviously, it's hard to stop your brain from going off. You almost have to remind yourself that 5 seconds in your head is probably half a second in the audience's. I've learned how to calm down. I've learned how to read the audience. I've learned how to interact with the audience, because before, if somebody shouted something, I would just go, you know, and then the whole set's ruined. You've been thrown off. Whereas now I think, hang on, what did they just say? What's a funny retort to that? How can this match into something else I'm doing? And it's getting that confidence, and that took a long time for me. That probably took about 2 or 3. I still don't think I'm quite. I'm never going to get. I don't think anyone gets to the point where they go on stage and go, this is perfectly normal and fine. I love being on stage in front of all these people judging me, because that's what it is, isn't it?
I think that nerve and that adrenaline rush is essential, isn't it? In any kind of creative.
But it's getting that confidence to be natural on stage. That's taken me a lot of time. My material's still rubbish, but
And are you on stage, or is there a persona? Because a lot of comedians have either a sort of a more defensive version of themselves in some ways. But are you, is Lindsay the same behind the scenes, or?
I think so. I think I'm at a slightly, if I'm on a dial of like, you know, 1 to 10, I think in the day to day at work, say if I was at work in office work, I'm a 3. Bit cheeky sometimes, keep it quiet. Normal life, I'm about an 8, 9. I'm quite difficult. And then on stage, I'm a 45 something going, yeah. So you have to whack it up a bit. You have to over exaggerate things.
Now, you've been very modest, I think, about your talent.
Thanks.
And it is a talent. And Joe Lycett, none other than Joe Lycett, the great up and coming comedian that he is, says that you're naturally hysterical and gifted.
gift.
So that's something at least you can put on the leaflets.
I'll do put it on leaflets.
So it must be nice, though, I think, to get that kind of feedback from, you know, sort of new comedians or kind of up-and-coming comedians. And then I guess there's a bit of a kind of, is there a bit of a sort of, I was going to say brethren, but, you know, they're not all gents. There's a kind of community, isn't there, of comedians?
Yeah, especially around the Midlands. I mean, there's a new material night called Rough Works that they run at the Glee Club, and that's really good, because you'll get people like Sarah Millican just rock up, which is bizarre. But generally it's localish comedians doing 5-10 minutes of new material, and you'll find that most people will turn up to that, even if they're, I'll go if I'm not on, just to be nosy and see what people are doing, and that gives you a nice little sense of community. And what you'll find is you'll drive to a gig in Liverpool and meet someone that you met in London last week.
Let's talk about Birmingham Comedy Festival.
Yes.
Which is fast approaching. So it runs from the 5th of October to the 14th of October.
It sure does.
And excitingly, you've got quite a good billing, I think, on this, because you're doing
what am I doing?
You're doing a half dayer, as they call it.
Well,
I thought it was to do a drinking, but it's not.
No, it's not. No, but I will be drinking afterwards. Tell you that for absolutely nothing. And I'm not doing comedy for half the day. It's
no, you're doing a kind of, you're doing a slot. Let's just get this in. You're doing Sunday, the 7th of October, at Cherry Red's, which is on John Bright Street, which is very near Grand Central, at 2:30 in the afternoon.
I am, and they do really nice chips. Like, if not for me, go for the chips, because they are really, really good. My show is called Lindsay Santoro Looks Like a Boiled Egg. Because, James, you try and rhyme something with Lindsay Santoro.
Yeah. It's a difficult one, isn't it?
It doesn't happen. There's not a thing.
It almost sounds, if you don't mind me saying, it almost sounds like a motor car, a Lindsay Santoro, you know?
It's thank you.
Like the Dacia Sandero, if you see what I mean.
I don't even know what that is. Okay. I've got a red car. Is that what I've got? You don't know my car, you've never seen it.
I'll come and have a look later.
Anyway.
So the half day, so you're not doing the whole half day, but you're doing a specific set, and you look like a boiled egg. And,
and you
work from there?
Yeah, well, basically,
there's no costume, is there?
I can't. No, there is. I could not think of a name for the show, and my other half was going, "You can't just call it. It needs a name." I said, "Oh, I don't know. I look like a boiled egg. Like I just said it like that." And then he submitted the form, so now it's Lindsay Santoro looks like a boiled egg, which is great. Fine, because I do. I bought a boiled egg costume from eBay, £14. Why? I haven't even written it in.
Did you have to bid? Was it?
Did I bid? Never bid. I can't stand the peril. It's too much, can you? You think, oh God, another penny. I might have this. I can't do it. You know, you can get apps now that sweep in.
Oh, really?
I can't be doing with that.
It's too much hard work.
Everything goes on Brexit.
So I was going to ask you about that because in the age of let's call it. The age of crisis. Let's not overblow it. But in this age of Trump and Brexit, how difficult is comedy in that sort of environment? Because some of it, opinions differ, but some of it is quite comedic, I think. You know, it writes itself, doesn't it, I think?
I stay away from political bits, mainly because I don't understand what's happening. I feel like I can't have any commentary on it because I just don't. I don't get it. That sounds like I understand what's happening, but I just think, is this real life? Am I dead? Because this is absolutely, how do you make this funny? Like, the world has gone bananas. So I will just stick to, I think sometimes comedy can be, I need to get out. I want to get away from it, maybe see something that takes my mind off it.
There is something in your work, that food is very much a theme, isn't it, I think? You know, and what I mean by that is, Maybe it's the social kind of impact of food.
Oh, I love food. I'm very much I was brought up on chips in the oven and smiley faces and fish fingers. You know, that's my type of level of food. So crisps are, I think, quite not nostalgic, but I often think when I eat a packet of crisps, I remember going to the social and my mum getting out a multi-bag from a bag and passing them around, like, not paying for these prices of crisps. Crisps are, I think, an integral part of society. You can get posh crisps now, did you know that? Oh, kettle crisps, look at me.
Vegetable crisps.
Beetroot crisps are not okay. I'm not.
They're not.
That.
You're
no,
against
they're
those.
Not. No, I love beetroot. I love crisps together. Not okay.
Let me just finally. Let's just ask. I want to ask you about ghosts. Okay. Not whether you've seen a ghost, but are there people from the comedy past that sort of haunt you in terms of, you know, influences or people you can't avoid in terms of sort of comedians that
I'm
you perhaps so grew up
sad
with? Or...
that you're actually not asking me about ghosts.
Well, I could ask you about ghosts.
I think you should ask me about ghosts now. I've never seen one, but I did go ghost hunting when I was 13. Yeah.
But you never caught anything?
No, I went to Dudley Castle once to speak to ghosts and they just didn't turn up. Maybe it's something to do with
not very
with
punctual.
No, they wouldn't be, wouldn't they?
But are there figures that you think, oh, that, you know, he or she's my favourite comedian? Or
I love Peter Kay. I think he's amazing. I think most of what he writes is so... That's the type of comedy I enjoy. It's the almost like the people's princess of comedy. That's what someone once described me as. And I was like, what? But it's that level of... How do I explain it?
It's that kind of common touch that
you're
talking about earlier on.
Yeah, that's it. It's familiarity and going, oh, I do that. Oh, I do that. Oh, yeah, I remember. Like, it's a bit nostalgic in some senses. That's the type of comedy I like. Like, he wrote Car Share. I thought that was brilliant. Phoenix Nights is incredible. I think that's one of my favourite things. Yeah, so he's... But he's not really a ghost, is he? He's retired now, so I guess Lee Evans. I loved Lee Evans when I was growing up. I thought he was brilliant. And I think a really big factor that's influenced my comedy was, you know, like the Monty Python films.
Hmm.
I never really watched the TV show, but when I was younger, my dad let us, I think I was about 13, let us watch The Life of Brian and The Holy Grail. And watching it back now, I think that's very inappropriate for a child. Like, but... So it just goes over your head, and I just used to find it funny, and it was daft, and I guess daft funny. That's what I love. That I love that sort of stuff. Daft funny, down to earth, down to earth. Here she is again with the down to earth rubbish.
Well,
crisps.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to wish you all the best for your half day that's coming up as part of the comedy festival, which, just to tell folks again, is the 7th of October.
Yes.
2:30.
I'm glad you know when it is.
Cherry Reds.
Don't
miss it. That's on John Bright Street. You can Google it. You can find all sorts of things online.
Yes.
But until then, Lindsay, I'm off to have a packet of prawn cocktail crisps, which is difficult to say.
Yes. As long as it's not beetroot crisps.
No, we won't have any beetroot. But until then, thanks so much. Thank you.
You live your best life. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Lindsay on Twitter at Hullseye. That's HULSEYE, and on Facebook. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to A.A. Abbott, Birmingham Comedy Festival and the players of Vacant Lot, Stourbridge Town Hall, Lindsay Santoro, 448 Creative, M7PR and Mac Birmingham. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.